From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
Rock historian Richie Underberger returns to the show this week. His work has appeared in countless publications, including Rolling Stone and Mojo. Richie Underberger has written great liner notes for a slew of CD reissues. He's the author of many great books on rock music, including books about the Beatles, The Who, The Byrds, Jimi Hendrix, The Velvet Underground, Fleetwood Mac. His new book is Bob Marley and the Wailers, The Ultimate Illustrated History. Richie Underberger, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Hi, Gary. Good to see you again.
So there's so much that I want to ask you about, and I want to get into your book about Marley in a bit, but let me ask you other junk first. What was your opinion of the Beatles single, Now and Then?
Okay, Gary, you might want to edit this out.
Okay.
I've only heard it a couple of times. It did not stick with me. It didn't interest me. I don't think it's a good idea to revive music in that way. I don't know if that's the kind of downer that you want to include in the broadcast.
I'm asking your opinion. That's what I want to know. It's fine. Whatever that opinion is valid.
Well, here's sort of an illustration. When I first heard her on the radio, I was parking at a Trader Joe's, which is very crowded, and you have to pay a lot of attention to how you park. And I parked and I went in and got some stuff and I came out, and it wasn't until I started the car again that I realized I didn't actually stay until the end of the song.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't imagine that ever happening, although I'm too young to have heard the Beatles singles when they first came out. I can't imagine that happening if it was the first time I heard Paperback Writer or the first time I heard Here Comes the Sun.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very artificial, not just for the Beatles, but I think in general. Let's go back and get this recording that hasn't been released, add stuff 40-odd years later, and fly in some material from somebody who's not around anymore.
Yeah, so you don't like it.
No. Well, but also, aside from the methodology, the song didn't strike me as special or memorable.
Well, had you heard that song before, you must have heard those Lennon tapes.
If I had heard it, I don't remember it. I don't have in my collection, I do not have all of those solo Lennon tapes. I know I wrote a book about the unreleased Beatles, but that was about what they did as a group. So I don't have all of their solo unreleased material.
Yeah. Uh-huh. What about the new Rolling Stones album? Do you have an opinion about that?
I've only heard a couple of songs, and to me it sounds like the usual album tracks that they've done from the early 1980s onward, where they don't measure up to what they had done in the 60s and 70s. As songs, they are not special to me. I'm a big Rolling Stones fan, but primarily of the first 10 years of their career.
Uh-huh.
So depending on what you want to do with your show, it's not what a lot of people want to hear.
I want to hear your opinions. That's why I'm asking. You don't have to worry about that. So let me ask you this then, because I know you know pretty much everything that can be known about music from the 50s, 60s, 70s. But do you not listen to contemporary music, or do you still enjoy contemporary music?
No, not much.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's my favorite era, and I'm primarily a historian for both what I write. I also teach a lot of adult education, non-credit courses in the Bay Area on rock and soul music history.
There was an anniversary very recently of the first appearance of the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. 60 years seems like a milestone. And I wonder, could you comment about the impact of that television appearance? Again, you were too young to remember it, but what do you think the impact of that was?
Even though I was just 2 years old, so I didn't see it when it was broadcast, I'm very familiar with the film footage and the news coverage from the time. And I don't think it can be overestimated, to be honest. Certainly at the time, the impact couldn't be overestimated. Even beyond that, it set maybe a record for the most viewed show at the time. It was like a Super Bowl of 1964 as a rough equivalent. The cultural impact was just immense. I still hear from people who are old enough to remember saying it was just the most amazing thing we had ever seen. And remember, in the United States, hardly anybody had heard of the Beatles even 6 weeks earlier. It was just a huge immediate impact that I can't think of another incident, not just in rock music, but in entertainment, where the impact was so huge, but also so long lasting. Because, well, there were a few factors. There had been a couple of British rock hits before the Beatles had I Want to Hold Your Hand. But British music was a very minor part of what you heard on the radio and what records were bought in the United States. And if you had told anybody in, say, early December 1963, the next biggest act is going to be from Britain, not just in rock music, but in all of entertainment, and also is just going to be the first of several dozen huge British groups of the mid-60s, and that British onslaught will continue forever. It's still got happening today, obviously. Everybody would have said, "You're out of your mind. Where is Liverpool anyway? I've never heard of it, even though it's a pretty big town. I never heard of that. And there's so much rock music here. What's going to happen in Britain that's going to be so different?" And it was, musically, most importantly, but also visually and with the Beatles image. And I know you know this from a couple of my books. One very significant musical impact was it motivated a lot of folk musicians who had sort of written off rock and roll, even though they were teenage fans, to move into rock, to use electric instruments. The Byrds and Bob Dylan are the most famous, but there are a lot more. And that itself was a cross-fertilization that enhanced rock and roll immensely. But as far as their multi-generational appeal, I don't have kids, but I have nephews and one niece, and I have a lot of friends with kids, some of whom are still like as young as 10 years old. And you never hear them say, "I don't like this stuff. It's my parents' music. It's too old-fashioned. I want to hear whatever, Beyonce or something like that." That's not to knock Beyonce, but it's when these young people discover it who were not born, and their parents sometimes were not born, they don't perceive it as well as like a historical piece. They're just really excited about it and they love it.
Oh, and what about their songwriting? I think you can't underestimate that as well. And that, I mean, before the Beatles, songwriting was not necessarily associated with performers. And if you wanted a version of Siri with the Fringe on Top, you could get Barry Como doing it or Doris Day doing it. But nowadays, if you want to hear the song you like, you must get it from the artist that recorded it. Can you trace that to the Beatles?
Quite a few rock artists before that who wrote most of their material, Chuck Berry, Buddy Holly, and only very slightly before the Beatles, the Beach Boys started recording. But the Beatles kind of made it a standard for most rock groups, maybe not all solo singers, but most rock groups. They shouldn't have songs written for them. They shouldn't even, like the Rolling Stones did when they started out, base their repertoire on let's get some American blues and soul songs, some of which are pretty obscure. They're never really heard anywhere, and do it our way. They did that great, but it was sort of a requirement. If you're going to be one of the top serious artists from like 1965 onward, you have to write most or all of your material. But also the songwriting itself, although I love the Beach Boys and even some groups that didn't make it really huge, like the Zombies, for what they did with songwriting. The diversity and the creativity of what they did and still making the song so accessible while being so adventurous in how they were written and recorded is unparalleled. It's amazing. God, isn't, and not just the songwriting, the vocals are amazing. It's almost unfair. How can you have two such great composers and singers in the same group, whose material is distinctly different but also complements each other. They also harmonize really well. And the lead guitarist, who's a very good guitarist anyway, he starts to write really good songs, not as much as John or Paul, but George Harrison adds another dimension. All that in one group. The Beach Boys were great, but Brian Wilson was easily the most famous and influential figure. The Rolling Stones are great, but virtually everything was written by Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, and virtually everything was sung by Mick Jagger. So I could go on, but those are just some of the things that I convey when I still teach courses about the Beatles.
Richie Underberger, you've been writing about rock and roll for a long time. I mean, I can't remember when I first saw your name and started reading your work, but tell me, when did you have your first thing published? Was it in a Rolling Stone, a Record Review or something?
They were, my first published writing was in a small magazine called Option Magazine. In 1983, I'm sorry, it was then called Op Magazine. And they specialized in independently produced and released music, but they would also run reviews of reissues that were on independent labels, including some really obscure music. That's when I was 21 years old. It was published in Olympia, Washington, although I've never lived there, but they published some of my stuff. When they stopped publishing, I was the editor for 6 years of a magazine called Option, which did not have an official relationship with Op, but the intention was to continue a similar magazine because the original editors and publishers didn't want to do it anymore. But that's the first places that I got published.
What was your first piece? Can you remember what the first thing you published was?
It was a batch of record reviews, so I'm not sure what they were. I do know that one of them, because I remember when I sent it in, it was some stuff that I had gotten very recently, a British band called The Sorrows from the mid-60s. They're very good. They had one minor hit in the UK. They were totally unknown in the United States. They're a little bit like the Pretty Things, who I think were the best British 60s group never to have a hit in the United States. So it was an example of, well, there's stuff to write about that hardly anyone has ever written about. And because it's a reissue, that is sort of something that will help get it published instead of saying, I want to write about The Sorrows. Well, who is this band? Well, they have a new release out, not a newly recorded record, but something that you can write about.
So The Sorrows sounded like the band that recorded P.F. Sorrow.
Yes, but they sounded like the earlier incarnation of the Pretty Things, when the Pretty Things sounded kind of like the Rolling Stones, because Dick Taylor, the lead guitarist, was originally in the Rolling Stones in 1962.
Oh, the rock family tree comes into play.
Yeah.
Well, and I know you've written a lot of liner notes. Is that fun?
Oh, yeah. And the most interesting parts, not just of liner notes, but writing in general for me, I like doing the writing, but the research is the most interesting, especially when you can find material that's little known or has never been known. Part of that is speaking to the musicians or anybody involved in the record. With the error, that's my favorite. I will say that's becoming harder and harder because a lot of those people now are in their 80s. And some of them, of course, still have really good memories. But the reality of our lifespan is that some of them aren't around anymore. More and more are not around anymore. And you can still find documents and unreleased tapes and stuff like that, but it's more of a challenge in some ways.
Well, I've had the opportunity here on From the Bookshelf to talk to some key people over the years. I had Jeff Emmerich on the show once. I talked with Colin Blunstone, lead singer of the Zombies. And, I've had Chris Hillman and Jorma Kaukonen and Terry Kirkman. It's always fun to talk to those people. So I wonder, who have you had a chance to talk to that you really treasure having interviewed them?
Even though it's not a figure who has seldom given interviews, the most important interview to me, it wasn't necessarily the best, although it was pretty good, was Roger McGuinn. Because for the 2-volume history of 1960s folk rock, I considered he was number one on my list. You can't always get number one on your list. I did a book on the Velvet Underground, and I'm doing another one now. I never got to talk to Lou Reed. But I think Roger McGuinn is the most important figure. This is a controversial opinion with a lot of people, but more important to me than Bob Dylan in making the transition from folk to rock. I'm also a bigger Byrds fan than I am a Bob Dylan fan, and it took a couple of tries. It's not rare that he's asked about the Byrds, but I got an hour with him on the phone, and as you might know, being an interviewer yourself, a key to getting people to talk and be enthusiastic is to ask them stuff that they haven't been asked a million times. It's things like, well, how did you come up with that riff for Mr. Tambourine Man? And he's a polite guy, so he would probably answer, but it's more interesting if you want to write about stuff that would excite readers, like I didn't notice before, to ask them things that maybe he has hardly ever or never been asked.
So what
So,
did you ask him?
well, I have to go back to the transcript, which is
Yeah.
over there. One thing I said was that the Byrds were very unstable as far as changing their lineup quite a bit. Even in their prime era, they changed. First, Gene Clark left, and then David Crosby left. Then Michael Clark left. They were down to two people. Maybe you talked to Chris Hillman about that. Was that about his new book?
But
Not
we
that
talked
new,
about
but like
everything.
2 or 3 years old. And I said, do you think that maybe the reason that you were less stable than, say, some of the big British groups you love, like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, was that the Beatles were all from the same town. And except for Ringo, they all knew each other from their teenage years. And Ringo was integrated very well when they got him in for Pete Best. Mick Jagger and Keith Richards grew up in the same London suburb. But the Byrds didn't know each other before 1964. They also came from all over the United States, Southern California, but also Chicago and the Midwest with Gene Clark and the Northwest for Michael Clark. Do you think that might have been a reason that you weren't as long-lived or you didn't get along as well? And he said, I never thought about that before, but you might be right. And he might have told this story before, but he said, well, here's an example of how it was different with the Beatles than the Byrds. The Beatles would argue among themselves, like every group does. But if anybody from outside of the group criticized any single person in the group, the whole group would close ranks and defend that person. You know, whether it was somebody saying Ringo's not a good drummer or, John's a loud mouth. All three of the others would come to this other guy's defense. He said, when people made fun of me, David Crosby would agree with them.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
And something else interesting, he said, when Gram Parsons joined the group, McGuinn had this ambition for maybe doing a double album that would sort of cover the history of American music from Appalachian folk to synthesizers, which he knew he was one of the first rock musicians to use synthesizers. And I said, personally, I've always regretted that you didn't do that. And he said, well, actually, we did. We just did it piece by piece over a series of albums. And that was an interesting way of looking at it. There's some country rock, and then there's some synthesizer experiments, and there's traditional songs, but they were modernized. The Space Oddity thing, Odyssey thing that concludes Notorious Byrd Brothers, there's all these synthesizers and electronics, but it's like a sea shanty. That's not something McGuinn told me, but that's just something I feel as a listener. It's like this fusion of the oldest music and in late 67, like the most modern technology available.
Well, it's fun to listen to that music again and examine it in different ways, and it's great to talk to the creators. I envy your job, and you do a great job of putting it all together in your books, which I also love.
Thanks.
If you ask people even today, Richie Unterberger, tell me the name of a reggae artist, they will say Bob Marley. Even though Bob Marley died in 1981, he's still the most famous reggae musician.
By far.
Yeah. And you've put together this book. It's like a coffee table book almost. Bob Marley and the Wailers, the Ultimate Illustrated History. And it's got a wonderful text that you wrote very well, but it's also got some great pictures and memorabilia. Is this your own memorabilia that's in here?
No, I should make it clear. I wrote all of the text, but the editors, the publisher, selected all the photos with a few suggestions from me. They have done, you probably know this, I guess you're on their mailing list. They have done quite a few books with that format, and I actually wrote one of the others, which is on Fleetwood Mac, but they've done Jimi Hendrix and various others.
And were you a Bob Marley fan?
Well, yes, but one of the reasons, this might be jumping ahead to a different question, but I hope that's okay. One of the reasons I wanted to do this book is that actually my favorite material by the Wailers is when all three of the principal Wailers were in the group. That's why Wailers is in the subtitle. It's not just a Bob Marley book. The other two important Wailers were Peter Tosh and Bunny Livingston, who changed his name to Buddy Wailer. And they were recording for 10 years before they had their first album that was internationally distributed by Island Records. And a lot of their best music is during those 10 years. And during those 10 years, the music changed a lot. I think it's a very interesting era. It might cover like one third of the book. And it really deserves more attention, not just because, well, it fills in some history that you should know about Bob Marley, but also the music, which is still not incredibly well known, is very good and interesting.
Yes, people know everything from roots rock reggae on, but they don't know that earlier stuff.
Yeah, or from Catch a Fire on. And the Wailers were not together, all three of those guys, on Island Records for very long, like a year. I also, in the book, cover what the other two main Wailers did after they left the Wailers, after they left Bob Marley. Not a huge amount of text, but I think some significant attention because they were important with what they did outside of Bob Marley as well.
Well, I think you could say that almost every form of popular music in America was originated with African Americans and popularized by whites. And I wonder if you could comment on what impact Eric Clapton's recording of I Shot the Sheriff had on Bob Marley's career.
I think that Clapton's cover of I Shot the Sheriff had an immense, and although not everyone would agree with this, positive impact on Bob Marley's career. It might seem, because there have been so many successful interpretations by white artists of songs that originated by black artists, that there was exploitation involved, or at the very least, well, Clapton got all the money and recognition that Marley should have had, but I don't think it's that simple. I Shot the Sheriff was not envisioned by Clapton as a single. It's kind of strange to think of now because it was a number one hit. But before something's a hit, you can't tell for sure. And he thought, this is, I'm paraphrasing, but it was like, well, that's not the single I would have picked. Or it's like strange. Why would they think that's going to be a hit single? And it was. But also, Bob Marley was not unhappy about this. He had put out his version. It wasn't a hit. And aside from theoretically, at least, he should have gotten a lot of publishing money for the sales from the Eric Clapton hit version. He actually talked to Eric Clapton to thank him for covering the song. He was figuring, well, it's going to make me more well known as a writer. This was still the time when Marley himself wasn't selling huge amounts of records. And although it's not in any quotes I found, I think he probably figured a lot of people, even if it's 25% with a number one single, that's a lot of people are going to look at the writing credit and they're going to think, well, who is this guy? And they can find out, or they'll hear it on the radio or read it in a review. This is a Bob Marley song originally, and they're going to be curious, what's the original sound like? Or at least, who is Bob Marley and What has he done? And when they go into it, it's not like, oh, he's just some friend of Eric Clapton's and he wrote this song, which would be a little bit dull. It's more like, well, actually, he's done a ton of records and he's from Jamaica, a black guy from Jamaica. And he's doing this music, which is very influenced by soul and rock, but it's a totally different kind of music, reggae music. And I think that actually enhanced Bob Marley's trajectory towards stardom in his own right.
Do you know how that song came to Eric Clapton's attention in the first place?
I don't remember offhand. I'm a little embarrassed because my name's in the book and I should know offhand, but, and I could double check later and email you, but reggae music, first of all, it was more well known in Britain than in the United States before Catch a Fire and the Wailers signed to Island Records, because the UK had and still has a very big Jamaican population, because Jamaica was a former British colony, did not declare independence until 1962. And that meant that there was a substantial market for reggae in the United Kingdom. And some people who weren't Jamaican heard the music, and not just because they might have happened to know somebody Jamaican, but some of it got on the radio and some of it you could see live. And British rock musicians, I think, and generally were more aware of reggae music. And that exposure increased when Marley and the Wailers signed to Island Records, which was primarily in 1973, a rock music label. So it would not have been unusual for Clapton or Keith Richards, but even in the United States, somebody like Bruce Springsteen, to have heard the original version of I Shot the Sheriff, now that Marley was on Island Records and he was getting significant FM radio airplay in the United States. And also, I think one of the coolest graphics in the book, because I just mentioned Springsteen, in 1973, there's an ad for Marley's appearance in New York at Max's Kansas City, a famous club. And he was sharing the bill with Bruce Springsteen. When Bruce Springsteen was 2 years away from having his first big hit with Born to Run. So can you imagine seeing them in a pretty small club? I was never at Max's, but I know how big it was. It wasn't very big. Both of those artists who are not so well known, but they already have a good repertoire, they're on their way up, sharing the same bill. It's just amazing.
Would have been a nice concert to have attended.
Yeah.
You know, before the explosion of reggae music, which I think you could trace to the Harder They Fall soundtrack album coming out, a lot of groups and individuals had heard reggae and wanted to capture that sound. Paul Simon, for instance, and even the Beatles attempted a ska sound, but they couldn't quite do it. Why is it that only the Jamaican records have that authentic reggae sound?
I think it just has a lot to, even though Jamaica is a very small country population-wise compared to North America or England, when you grow up in that environment, especially when reggae was just being formed, and you are steeped in the folk music and rhythms that are indigenous to Jamaica, it's something that's a lot more in your DNA than it would be if you're in the US or Canada. Now there are reggae bands all over the world. It's not just English-speaking groups or Japanese ones and African ones. But I think that actually being there cultivated that very distinctive rhythm, first ska, then it slowed down to rock steady, then it slowed down even more with a more irregular rhythm to reggae. Also, lyrically, I think the influence of Rastafarianism is very important. That is a faith that is much more popular in Jamaica than maybe anywhere else. And that, I think, was a crucial factor in making the lyrics that not just Marley and Tosh and Livingston were writing, but all reggae artists were writing, more socially conscious, more spiritually influenced. And that is something, even there are Rastafarians all over the world, of course, but being in a place where that is such a popular, not just faith in sheer numbers, but also an attitude, I think, that is much more a part of everyday life in certain communities, that is also going to be something that comes out in lyrics more organically and frequently than it would anywhere else.
In those 10 years that you were talking about, when Bob Marley and Bunny Wailer and Peter Tosh were getting started, how influenced were they by American vocal groups?
The Wailers were extremely influenced by American soul groups. I think that reggae, in some ways, it's an offshoot of soul music. It's distinctly different, but it's hugely influenced, especially when reggae was starting to come into being. Even with ska, which is a much faster music, the lyrics are like a lot of soul music from that time, mostly concerned with love and partying and dancing and having a good time. The American vocal groups from the 50s onward were massive influences. The biggest influence on the early Wailers, I think, easily, and people associated with Marley testified to this, was Curtis Mayfield and the Impressions. And they did some of their material, but even aside from that, the vocal arrangements were, well, they are, when you listen to their records from the mid 60s, they're very easily audible. But I would also say groups like the Temptations were influences. The song that Peter Tosh did with Mick Jagger, this is like the late 70s, Don't Look
Walking
Back.
the back.
And Tosh had done it earlier by himself too. That's a Temptations song. It's just not a big Temptations hit.
Yeah. Oh,
But
I love
even back to the 50s, I think the Platters were very influential and the Drifters. The Jamaican groups loved those harmonies, and there were many examples. Toots and the Maytals might be the most famous of those groups, but there are groups which are primarily known to reggae collectors, like the Ethiopians or the Paragons, who did the first version of The Tide Is High, which Blondie made into a huge hit
Yeah.
in the 70s. And
The
maybe
Mighty Diamonds
some,
also have that sound, don't they?
but yeah, Mighty Diamonds is a good example. And also, the way that the records were produced with some horns, especially in early ska, you hear a lot of horns,
Yeah.
brass in the arrangement. A difference, one reason I think reggae came out differently, the technology in the mid 60s for recording was way behind the United States and UK and probably Europe too. Sometimes when I do adult education classes on music history, I'll play like Dancing Shoes, which is a 1966 single by the Wailers. And virtually none of the students have heard it because it's not that well known. And I asked them, doesn't that sound to you more like a recording from 1956 than 1966? And they're like, yeah, it sounds more like the Five Satins in the Still of the Night or something like that. Then certainly, like the Temptations Get Ready, which sounds pretty close to how things are recorded these days. Pretty soon, certainly by the 80s, Jamaican technology caught up, and you can make records in Jamaica that sound as technologically advanced as anywhere in the world. I think before that, in the 70s, the Rolling Stones did some recording there in the 70s. But in the mid 60s, it was different, and that also couldn't help but make the music sound different, not always in a negative way. Yeah, it's tinier and it's like one track or two track. It's not four track or eight track. But it also meant that the musicians usually were performing live, and I think the spontaneity really carries through. And when they were thinking, we want our music to be heard outside of Jamaica, that kind of forced them to be creative in the studio with the more limited tools that they had. And this is a little beyond what Marley did, but for instance, the producer Lee Perry, who pioneered dub music with all the echo and reverberations and the mixing, it doesn't sound like any of the studio experiments from Europe or the United States. It sounds distinctly something that's an outgrowth of Jamaican reggae.
And Lee Perry did cross paths with the Wailers as well, right?
Yeah, and Lee Perry, who had a very long and influential career, he was also known, it's not a secret, for often not getting along with his collaborators. So the association with the Wailers was fairly short, if productive. And one reason that not just the Wailers, a lot of reggae business relationships are pretty fraught, is that until it became an international music, business-wise, it was really hard just to make a living doing reggae music, because Jamaica is a small country. Most of the records were only bought in Jamaica, but the music business was not very ethical. That is true all over the world. But it's amazing to me, this is something that is mentioned in the book, the Wailers were one of the most popular groups in Jamaica, starting in 1964. 2 years later, Bob Marley leaves and moves to Delaware for 8 months. A big reason is that his mother had moved there and she had gotten married to an American. But another reason was he could make more money doing menial jobs there than being a reggae star in Jamaica. And he saved some money and brought it back to Jamaica, in part because he wanted to start his own record label, because he and the Wailers were tired of not getting paid for the hit records that they did have. Can you imagine Curtis Mayfield taking a job in a steel factory because he's not making enough in the impressions? There was a lot of discrimination against blacks in the United States in the 60s, but you could make a decent living if you were the Temptations or the Impressions.
There's been a lot of fear, I think, lately, and with good reason, that a performer, you know, people are talking about, well, maybe somebody would try to shoot Taylor Swift while she's performing because of her now political affiliation. And that actually happened to Bob Marley. He was actually shot while on stage. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, to clarify, he wasn't shot while he was on stage, but there was fear that that would happen. There was an attempt on his life. It was at his home. But the context was that it was shortly before he was to do a concert. And there's still, I don't think it's like the JFK assassination here. Are we going to get to the bottom of that in our lifetimes? Personally, I don't think so. It's sort of the same thing there. Bob Marley didn't run for office, but his stardom was so huge in Jamaica by 1976 that he was in some ways more influential than any politician could be there. And the two main political parties both wanted his endorsement, as they were sort of jostling to get the head of state office. And there was a reggae concert that he was going to be headlining, and sort of without his knowledge, there was intimation in the promotion for the concert that one of the parties was affiliated with this concert. So there's speculation that the more conservative party did not want the concert to go ahead because that could have swayed the election if it was interpreted that Bob Marley is endorsing the more liberal party. That's just one speculation why there was an attempt on his life at his home shortly before the concert happened. And it was a really bungled assassination. I mean, he was barely hit. It's just amazing, in some ways, good fortune, as tragic as this was. Rita Marley, like, was driving out to get help, and a bullet literally grazed the top of her scalp. So it's like if it had been, you know, a fraction of a millimeter lower or something like that, she would have died probably. So she was wounded, but actually not seriously hurt, nor was Bob Marley. And the amazing sequel to that is that Marley went ahead with that concert.
Isn't that amazing?
But there was fear, certainly, that, oh, maybe somebody from the audience who's crazy is going to try and shoot Marley on stage, and whether he or she would get Marley or not, it's going to be terrible at a really crowded concert. Well, there was not an attempt on his life at that concert, so that took a lot of courage, because I think if he had said, I'm not doing this concert, it's too unsafe, nobody would have criticized him.
Yeah, of course not. Yeah. Well, just mentioning Rita Marley makes me reminds me that I want to ask you about the marvelous sound of the i3s and their presence on the records of Bob Marley and the Wailers.
I think that Rita Marley, she's almost an honorary Wailer. Going back to before the i3s, there were three women. That's why they're named the i3s. Had backup vocals for most of Marley's music. She married Bob Marley in 1966, and she was hugely important to his career musically. She is often singing harmonies on the records, even though she was seldom credited as a full Wailer back in those days. But she also did a lot to help Bob on the business side. Like when Bob Marley tried to form his own label without much money, it's such a weird image. They would sell records from their home because they didn't want to go through distributors who might not pay them. And they were sold through a cage. And that might sound like, oh my God, that's terrible. Bob is putting his wife in a cage so she doesn't go anywhere. No, it was because they didn't want people to steal the records. It was nothing like that. I want to make that clear. And I think, I'm sure Bob also worked there as well. So she put a lot of commitment behind trying to make Bob a star, helping with his music, but also with his business. And this is a part of Marley's life that can't be ignored. He was only married once to her, and they were still married when he died. But he had relationships with a lot of women. He had children with a few women, including, of course, Rita Marley. Of course, it's a very musical family. Some of their offspring made records. Ziggy Marley is a very big star in his own right. And I'm sure that was very hard on her because it was even public knowledge when Bob Marley was alive. And it wasn't just one other woman, it was several other women have borne children to Bob Marley. They probably just reached some sort of understanding, but it didn't. She still felt all along, I'm sure she was angry and hurt at some of Marley's womanizing, but her dedication to his music was unwavering. And also, the i3's harmonies were very important for the Wailers, especially when Tosh and Livingston left, because they had been such good harmony singers. So they could pick up the harmonies in a different way. But also, when you see film footage of the band, unfortunately, there is a lot from the last like 8 years of Marley's life. They were so visually distinctive with their really colorful dresses and, headgear and the way that they sway back and forth. So, although I personally wish that Peter and Bunny had been able to remain in the band longer, that was something that was maybe not possible while they were in the band, which really added a lot to their concerts, especially.
Well, what caused them to leave the Wailers, Peter Tosh and Bunny Wailer?
There are several explanations, but one of the ones, which is maybe a cover for something else, Jamaica, of course, has a very warm climate. The Wailers had moved to London in part to get a record deal that would get their records out all over the world, and they did so with London's Island Records. Of course, when you get that deal, you're expected to tour. It wasn't like, well, we were already stars, and now you're just switching to a different label. And England, I've been to England a lot. It's not like going to Siberia or something like that, but it's a lot colder than Jamaica, especially in the winter. There's a lot of rain there as well. I've experienced that. It's not that bad. I mean, the temperature's sometimes in the 40s and raining. But he would say that a reason that he left was that he couldn't stand touring in that climate. That could be just a cover because Bunny Wailer had a long solo career after he left the Wailers. And he toured a lot. I'm sure at least sometimes it was below 70 degrees where he was playing. I think maybe a bigger reason was the Wailers were a group. It was not Bob Marley and the Wailers, like Bill Haley and the Comets or something, where there's a leader who does easily the most visible work in the group. Both of those other guys sang lead a fair amount and also did some writing. Not too much, Bunny. Peter, a fair amount. Neither of them as much as Bob, but they complemented each other very well in the same way a group like the Beatles or the Birds, they have several good singer-songwriters with different styles, but they blend. When the Wailers were on Island Records, I do think that Chris Blackwell, the head of Island, but also the whole label, felt that Marley is the guy who should be the frontman because he's the one who has the most charisma and the most talent. And that's generally true. But the other two guys had a lot of talent, not just as individuals, but how they could blend as a group with Bob Marley. When Catch a Fire and Burnin' came out, it was mostly Bob Marley songs. And he was getting most of the press attention and the public attention. And I think both of those guys felt, well, we have more to offer. And there were other songs that could have been on those records. This is all hindsight, but I wish that Catch a Fire could have been a double album. That's very unlikely. The first major album a group has, it's very uncommon that it's a double album. But you could have had something like the White Album where you have more diversity and more voices heard, but enough strong material to fill up that double album. I think they felt like they were getting edged out as creative forces and wanted to go on their own. And I think that would have been inevitable, but maybe with some more diplomatic handling, at least they could have stayed together for, say, three albums on Island with more room for the other guy's songs instead of the very brief period that they had. And like Peter Tosh especially was pretty productive as a solo artist when he left. And Wailer, not so much as a songwriter, but he was about 50 years.
Yeah, right.
He had a solo career. He died pretty recently.
Yeah. Well, Legalize It by Peter Tosh was a huge record.
Yeah. It's almost as much a standard as Bob Marley's biggest hits.
Yeah. Catch a Fire did have some elaborate album cover packaging. It was kind of unusual to have an album like that. That must have cost some money. You know, there was a big lighter that opened up and had fire coming.
Yeah, and Chris Blackwell has been very specific about that, feeling that that sort of design was important to gaining the Wailers a following among the white rock audience, which I don't think is a sellout, by the way. I think it's expanding an audience. The only influence he had in their music was that he rocked it up a bit by getting some non-Jamaican electric guitar players on there, giving it a little bit more of a rock feel. But I don't think he sold out the music with the way that the Wailers records were produced. And the Wailers did not complain about that. Maybe they were thinking, well, we shouldn't complain because we have a much bigger record deal and we can put up with that. But even in retrospect, they didn't really rag on that approach. And I think it was a basically successful approach. It wasn't like Catch a Fire became a top 10 hit. But the audience for the kind of music that they were doing on Island just built and built. And a lot of people rediscovered those records. I don't know how much Catch a Fire has sold now, but I bet it's sold at least 20 times as much as it did in its first 2 years because Marley's catalog is so big.
Yeah, now, posthumously. Well, the album, nowadays, marijuana is legal in many states, including California. But when Rastaman Vibration came out, it was still an illegal substance. But the inside of the album cover had a little ridge, and it said, this album, great for rolling herb.
Yeah, which in 1973, a lot of people, even people who used that substance, wouldn't have known what it meant. It was this more Jamaican sort of slang. And that, I think, did enhance their appeal in the rock underground, but maybe that factor has been overemphasized. And if it had been, oh, this is one of the key ways we're going to get people to listen to the music, that would not have meant that the music would have lasted more than 50 years and running as it does now. That's not enough to make the music a big part of popular culture.
But the greatness of the music might be a part of the legalization eventually of marijuana.
That's possible. And not just in the United States. It's not a secret. A lot of Jamaicans back then used marijuana, not just for recreation, but also as sort of a religious sacrament. And it's something that did inform some of their lyrics. Not a huge amount of Marley's lyrics, I would say more of Tasha's lyrics.
Bob Marley died in 1981. He was only, I don't know, when he was in his early 30s.
Late 30, mid to late 30s, yeah.
And was his death preventable?
That's still unknown, and it's still kind of strange to me. I know you know this, and probably a good number of listeners. He died of cancer that spread like throughout his body. It's sometimes attributed to an injury he had to his toe playing soccer, or he would call it football, which is the British term. And I'm not a medical expert, but I'm thinking if you have, how do you get cancer through a athletic injury? It's not something I really hear about. Something to a foot. Sure, if there is cancer in the foot, it can spread, but how does a soccer injury cause that? I never understood that. But I do think this is real sad looking back. There's a good chance, and I'm not an expert about this, but if he had agreed to have that toe that was the injured part amputated, he might have lived without significant other problems. He didn't want to do that because. And hear me out with these two reasons. One might sound kind of frivolous. He was a very enthusiastic soccer player. He knew that losing a toe, you probably can't play well anymore, or at least at the level you were. But also, it's evident from the film footage of Bob Marley, he danced around a lot on stage. He was a very animated performer, and he felt that without even the toe, it's not like losing a foot or a leg, but even without that, he couldn't do what he was used to doing on stage. And he also felt like consulting with various possible methods of treatment, I can take care of this without going to the extremes. And if that was the case, he was probably wrong. This is all hindsight. Certainly, to do it over again, maybe even Bob Marley would agree. That, yeah, that's worth the sacrifice, of course. If I can live a normal lifespan, maybe still be performing today when he's almost 80, certainly that's worth it. It's worth having to stand in one spot on stage and just watch soccer, don't play soccer anymore. But there was some denial, and it's not uncommon when people are this seriously ill. When he was on his last tour, and he got really ill. He was kind of like, well, just get me out in the back on the playing field. If he got this horrible diagnosis, like you probably only have 3 months to live or something like that. No. I'm going to live. I'm just going to continue the tour. And he only continued for like one more show. His last show was in Pittsburgh. And it became obvious you really can't. No matter how hard you want to do this, you really can't. It's not just, oh, this is for your own good. We have to address this now. You really can't do this. You're not in a condition to put up with it. As it happens, I've lived in California for 41 years, but I grew up in the Philadelphia suburbs and I went to college in Philadelphia at the University of Pennsylvania. The next concert that he would have done was at the would have been at the University of Pennsylvania, but he didn't do it.
And
And
so you never saw him live?
I did not see him live. And I do remember at the time the report, I mean, like the next issue or the issue after that of Rolling Stone, Bob Marley was quoted, there's nothing the matter with me. But it came out later that, well, no, in New York, when you were trying to start this tour, you got this diagnosis. They found all this disease in your body. And it wasn't. I mean, he lived about another 6 months. It was really serious. He tried all sorts of holistic treatments, but that might have prolonged his life a bit, but it couldn't stop it.
Well, Richie Underberger, if you were going to choose a Bob Marley song, you mentioned Dancing Shoes is one you play for your students, but if you were going to say, you know, if someone had never heard Bob Marley, which of his recordings would you say this is the essential Bob Marley recording?
Well, there are. I can't really, it's like a what's your favorite Beatles song, which I'm sometimes asked. It's hard to single out one, but I think that Get Up, Stand Up is not just one of his best songs, but it's a really good example of how, as a songwriter, he was able to distill a very important message into something that was very direct and easy to understand. Even though when you heard Bob Marley speak rather than sing, because of the Patois Jamaican dialect, he could be very hard to understand for people who didn't grow up in Jamaica. That wasn't the case when he sang. And the way he phrased things and sang them, it was a very direct, easily grasped message, and not only to English speakers. He still is one of the most popular performers worldwide. I mentioned Japan, but I was in Sicily in 2017. And besides songs by the Beatles, the songs you were most likely to hear by buskers playing for change were Bob Marley songs. And yeah, maybe some of them were visiting students from Britain, but they weren't all. And obviously not all the people in Sicily, not just a lot of Italians, a lot of people from all over Europe and even Japan and all around the world. He's a hugely popular performer still in Africa. Some countries in Africa speak English. Some of them don't. And I think that non-English speakers, where English is the second or third language, or maybe they hardly know any English at all, they can understand the songs, not just because the words are very direct, but also the combination of the words and music makes people want to listen. And they get the message, the basic message, even if they don't exactly know what get up, stand up means. That's one example. And I do think I Shot the Sheriff is a really good song musically, but also lyrically. Unfortunately, in this country and in some other places in the world, people of color are often bullied or even shot by the authorities for unjust reasons. And it might sound like a gangster song, like this guy's gunslinger from a Western, but it's not only that, because he says it's a very important part of the lyric, but I swear it was in self-defense, like it sometimes is in those cases where the people get shot or go to jail for a long time. And a song that is not maybe the one to start with to get an idea of his sound, but which I think is very interesting, is Redemption Song, because that's recorded near the end of his life. And it's more of a almost folk or singer-songwriter song, especially the way it's recorded, than it is a reggae song. And it's an indication, if he had lived and continued to do music, maybe he would have explored some different directions, which weren't 100% reggae. But also the way that it is sung, I don't think it was conscious, but it's almost like, this is my farewell statement. This is when I want to leave the world.
Well, the book is called Bob Marley and the Wailers, The Ultimate Illustrated History, and the author, my guest, the brilliant Richie Unterberger. Richie, thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf. I hope you come back again soon.
Thank you for having me on, Gary.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.